You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Larry Spotted Crow Man about his book, The Morning Road to Thanksgiving. And we dive into the history, truths, myths, and the complex story behind Thanksgiving so we can all step up to the plate of acknowledging our history and committing to being change in the present.
The book's called The Morning Road to Thanksgiving, and it's a story of a Native American man that takes place in contemporary times. He's very upset about the treatment of Native American people, indigenous people around the world, and his people of the East. And it comes to a head for him, and he decides he wants to do something about this. He wants to not only heal himself, but he wants to heal Native people everywhere. And he figures he can do this by ending America's Thanksgiving. It's a heart-wrenching, daring, and sometimes humorous journey that it's not just a litany of hardship and loss that you would expect in some of these stories, but it's also, it's a journey of healing, and it reveals the healing spirit within all of mankind.
When God stood before you with her hands on her hips, she said, I'll accept love and loving words from your lips. She said, everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good, good, and how. I need you to be love right now. I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Iguanu. Hello and welcome. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawn Land. It's a gray and cloudy day here in Bunawabskek territory, which is located in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And as always, my wonderful co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun, is bringing the warmth and sunshine to me on this day. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. It's also a beautiful turning of the seasons. I think I say that every show, but it's true every show. Here in Taos, New Mexico, where the autumn is giving way to the first snows, and we're all happy to see it. It was a very dry, warm, strange autumn here at high altitude in the desert, and we're happy to get a little bit of moisture. We always are throughout the year. You know, this is our Thanksgiving week show that we're recording today, and Sherry and I decided that we would tackle the subject head on because that's what we like to do. So Sherry has a friend named Larry Spotted Crow Man who has written a book called The Morning Road to Thanksgiving. Now Larry is a citizen of the historical Nipmuc tribe of Massachusetts. He's an internationally acclaimed writer, poet, cultural educator. He's a traditional storyteller. He's a tribal drummer and dancer and a motivational speaker. He's on the board of the Nipmuc Cultural Preservation, which is an organization set up to promote the cultural, social, and spiritual needs of the Nipmuc people, as well as an educational resource for Native American studies. He travels throughout the U.S. and Canada and also through Europe, and we are very glad to have him on the show today to talk about his book and to explore this theme of Thanksgiving in depth and in ways that maybe some of our listeners, we didn't get so much when we were sitting down in our public schools, and maybe to other part of our listeners, you got to get this story in a whole different dimension than what's usually taught in the U.S. So we know that you guys out there listening to the show, you're a broad range of supporters and listeners, and we appreciate that, and we know that you'll enjoy going deep on this subject with us. Sherry, how about you lead in with the first question?
Welcome, my friend. How's the weather down there in the Boston area?
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Sherry and Rivera, for having me on. I just want to say that right up. Really appreciate you giving me this time to share about the book. And the weather is typical in New England, which means it's constantly changing. So
that's right.
Right now, it's a little cloudy and some wind, but it's nice. It's a nice day out.
Well, we would love to dive right in and talk with you about your book, The Morning Road to Thanksgiving. And for our listeners, morning in this instance is M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. Can we start right off by you giving a synopsis of the book?
Certainly. So yes, the book's called The Morning Road to Thanksgiving. It took me about 4 years to write. And it's a story of a Native American man. It takes place in contemporary times. He has been tormented by his childhood memories and nightmares, which gets revealed in the story. But he's also very upset about the treatment of Native American people, indigenous people around the world, and, you know, primarily his people of the East. And it comes to a head for him, and he decides he wants to do something about this. He wants to not only heal himself, but he wants to heal Native people everywhere. And he figures he can do this by ending America's Thanksgiving. It's a heart-wrenching, daring, and sometimes humorous journey that it's not just a litany of hardship and loss that you would expect in some of these stories, but it's also, it's a journey of healing, and it reveals the healing spirit within all of mankind. That's what I really try to do with this story. It's surprising to many because there is certainly a message there for Native people. There's a message there for non-Native people, and it's really a story that's significant for our time. It deals with all the contemporary issues, and it sets the plate by giving you the historical background. I started with that because, as we know, unfortunately, many people, as you opened up talking about, don't know much about the first Thanksgiving or the indigenous people of the East. So it was very important for me to start off with the historical background to set up the story and then take you on the journey of these people who are traversing through their world in this contemporary time of ours. And you need to know how they got there, how Nipa Stone Toe, that's the main character's name, Nipa, which in our language means thunder. So you need to know how he got to where he got. And he comes from parents who were, during the 70s and 80s, they were civil rights activists for Native American issues primarily. They were part of some of the movements. And so he grew up around that. And also him and his sister, Kina. So this was kind of ingrained in him to take this journey. But as you'll hear in the story, there are many things that became obstacles for him in his life that really had him messed up, as it were. But also he has a sister who's a few years younger than him. And she becomes an RN, a nurse, here in Massachusetts town. And even though she'd grown up in this house with these traditional teachings and this very activism mentality, she kind of traversed away from that. And she says, well, you know, yes, I'm a Native person, but, you know, I kind of don't want to focus on that. I want to be mainstream. I just want to be an American. And her brother kind of come to a head because, as I said, he's trying to change the world through ending this holiday because he sees the hypocrisy in it. He sees this as a symbol of the destruction of indigenous people. This holiday is literally the embodiment of all the destruction that happened to them. So he's trying to get his sister on his side. He comes back to Massachusetts after being away for some time. And again, that part gets revealed in the story. And he really goes on this mission to change Thanksgiving. And obviously, as we all know, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry. It's a trademark. So he's going up against this giant, this industry of Thanksgiving. So he gets his cousin, Wavy. And I don't want to give away too much of the story, but you kind of get the idea of what's going on and what he's up against. And you get to see indigenous people living. You get to see how they interact with non-Native people. And what I really wanted to do in the story is, me being a Native historian and somebody who's kind of grown up much like me, but, you know, not exactly, but with a total understanding of what happened to my grandparents and what they went through as indigenous people here in the East. And these are a lot of things that I teach when I go on my talks about some of the things that my family have gone through. So it certainly affects us. And we talk about that with our intergenerational trauma that we experience. So it was very easy for me to give an account of all the atrocities that happened, the boarding schools, the removals, the usurping of lands and the discrimination and so on. And talk about how Native Americans weren't citizens until 1978 and so on. But what we find is that these kind of talks or these kind of teachings tend to push people away, and because they don't want to fully accept their role, their responsibility. You know, and I hear a lot of people will say today, well, yeah, I had nothing to do with, murdering and stealing Indian land. And, you know, that was a long time ago. And I say to them, well, you had nothing to do with George Washington and Abe Lincoln, but you're in the Constitution, but you always make claim of that. You always, you know, that's the highlight of your premise when you speak about the greatness of this country. You had nothing to do with that. So you can't claim that part without claiming the other part, too. So we're all in this together. And that's what I really tried to do in the story, is show that we're all one.
Larry, In the story, you posit the ending of the celebration of Thanksgiving. Is there something else that takes its place? Something that, not a holiday, so to speak, because there's a lot to commemorate, acknowledge, mourn, grieve, take responsibility for, as you've been saying. Is there something that people do instead of Thanksgiving, or is it just where we get rid of it altogether?
Well, again, like I tell people, the characters and my own personal feelings are always separate. And sometimes, especially family members, they have a hard time seeing it because they'll see themselves in the story. And that's the beauty of the Morning Road to Thanksgiving. It doesn't tell you to end Thanksgiving. It doesn't tell you what to do. And one of my great people I admire, philosophers, Alan Watts, talks about, we're just there to watch. We're just there to watch what happens. And that's what I really wanted to do. So you're seeing Native people of the East interacting with non-natives and interacting with themselves. And you're watching, you're the observer, and you can come to a decision how this resonates within you. It's not trying to push anything on anybody. But however, what we have, and tribes have different celebrations throughout the U.S. and Canada as far as ceremonies, but what we have here in Nipmunkland is we have a harvest moon ceremony, and that would, I suppose, that would be similar to what we call, it's a day of giving thanks. But as we always like to say, every day is a day of Thanksgiving as we make our offerings in the morning with our tobacco and our smudge. We make our offerings every day. But the harvest moon ceremony is what we have around that same time of year. And it's essentially giving thanks for the harvest, all the goodness that the Creator has put forth to us. And we just had ours not that long ago. And I remember one of the elders talked about when there's a shortage of food or things like that, it's not always about the food and the material things. Because sharing love and sharing kindness is a harvest. When you're sharing that time, talking to someone, that's also part of the harvest. So, and that was part of the goodness that we share when you talk about different ways. And again, the important thing about the Morning Road to Thanksgiving, it doesn't try to persuade, it's not a persuasive argument to get people to stop celebrate, but it's just putting out the information about how the first Thanksgiving actually was celebrated, such as by the slaughter of the Pequots down in, the Mystic, when they came in and killed the Pequots, and that was literally the first Thanksgiving. They celebrated it. And that's a quote in the book. These are all historical facts that people aren't aware of. And then we talk about that first Thanksgiving dinner with Massasoit and the warriors, how this group of natives and English people came together. I jokingly talk about that, but it's really not funny because that was actually America's first segregated meal because English people, especially the men, were very careful to keep their families away from Native people because lest they be bewitched, because they were very fearful of the practice of indigenous people. The ceremonies and the moon ceremonies that I just mentioned, these things were creeped out by them. And as we know, they had just gone through the Inquisitions and burning people up as witches and so on. So here these brown-skinned people doing all these ceremonies, that really like gave them the chills. So they were very careful to keep their families away from them. So it was likely the Indians were on one side and the English were on the other side having this meal. And there was no table. The people were sitting on the ground in little corners here and there. So that's kind of how it was more likely shared.
Larry, as you know, one of the things that we face as Native peoples is the denial of our authentic identity. And so when we think about these Thanksgiving stories, they never refer or very rarely refer to the tribe by name that participated in the meal that you're talking about with Massasoit, that they're just the Indian people who met the pilgrims. And so one of the things that Ben Franklin said, which kind of falls in line with this, is that the Indian are a sketch in red crayon, a placeholder set here to hold this space for the noble white man who would later come. And so when we have these depictions, these stories from Thanksgiving of the nameless, generic Indian who is there at the invitation of the pilgrim, which is completely false. It was the other way around. This was the sachem's feast or the chief's feast day that the settlers, the pilgrims, were invited to by the Wampanoag. When we hear these stories, again, it's like, this generic Indian in place who's just there to meet the pilgrims. And so when we start thinking about this and thinking about things like mascots, all of these images that deny the authentic identity of the tribal peoples involved really helped to perpetuate this idea of the Indian as a non-entity, like Ben Franklin talked about, just this kind of generic sketch that is seen in contrast or in relation to the white man in some way. So,
well, exactly. That's why when I opened up the book with the historical background, and of course, you know, we talk about Massasoit, and I really tried to give an in-depth picture of who Massasoit was and how later in life he changed his name to Omosequin, which means yellow feather, and he moved to a place not too far from here, where, for lack of a better terms, he retired. And at that time, that's when his first son, Wamsutta, took over, and he was poisoned by the English. And then that's when King Philip, his younger brother, ended up taking the leadership. Metacom is his name, and he was dubbed King Philip. And, you know, and then hence we had the King Philip's War. But this has been the issue that we've been experiencing and continue to experience, as you said, with the mascots. We become the artifact of entertainment and fiction and, you know, just kind of a caricature of our own lives to people who don't care to take the time to learn. The Morning Road to Thanksgiving gives you people that you'll pass down and see in everyday life. These are indigenous people and that do a lot of the same things they do, except they have this history, this unique history with the United States that projects out in their lives to give them different experiences that people don't understand and subjected them to experiences that people don't understand. Much like I was talking about earlier, like the boarding school experience and the historical discrimination that we've experienced, and that affects our life. I was talking to somebody the other day about the Dakota Access Pipeline. I said, you know, we're out here fighting for these issues. These are things we like just have to do instead of working on science, astronomy, writing poetry, love songs, sharing, walking in the forest with our children. We can't do that because we got to fight just to exist. So these take away these things take away the quality of our life. So we spend years and time fighting and preparing statements and learning about the laws that they've used against us just to for the right to exist. And we could be taking part in the beauty of life, but we have to continue to fight. So these are physical and mental and spiritual distractions that we continue to have to endure just for the right to exist. And again, that's what I wanted to explore in the Morning Road to Thanksgiving. And people really get to see that with the character and other people and the non-native people who they interact with and the non-native people who have their arguments about why they feel they do. And I wanted to make everybody real, nice, round characters, right? So they're not just these people being this angry white man or this angry Indian. They're real people, and they speak their case eloquently. And then you're like, well, does that make sense to me? Does that make sense? Is that reality? Is their perspective a reality of what I see in the real world? And this is what people experience. They have their perspective, but a lot of times their perspective is not the tangible reality that is seen. You know, in other words, you'll hear, well, Indians are rich. They all got casinos. And then you hear about how they're, you know, the most impoverished people in the country, or they have some kind of free stuff. We don't get anything free, you know? So these are all myths, and the mascots are the perpetuation of that, where it's okay. And I've said it before that Native people seem to be the last vestige of safe racism, and a sad but true fact, whereas people are allowed to do and say a lot of things that it doesn't come under the scrutiny that you would see of other groups. And some people argue, well, they're only 1% of the population. Well, that doesn't really hold water either, because Jewish Americans are also 1% of the population, and certain things aren't allowed. But however, these things continue to happen to us. And then people say, well, Natives aren't making enough noise. Oh, we make a lot of noise. It's just that I believe that it is the interest of America not to highlight the atrocities, because it doesn't really serve them in a way to bolster how great this country is, bolster how free and the land of the free and all this other stuff, because it really speaks to how this country was built on genocide and empire building and hegemonic rule over indigenous and black people. And they really don't want to come to terms with that. So, and that's what I tried to open up with the Morning Road of Thanksgiving, and not with a really in your face way, but just kind of letting people observe what history has done to people, because it doesn't happen in a vacuum, what history has done to individuals and on both sides of the spectrum.
Larry, I think one of the things that you touched upon that really struck a chord with me as a non-Native person is the inability of white Americans, I'm going to name them very clearly, to deal with the truth of their past. Now, they used to very strongly justify all of their actions through the belief in white supremacy, and particularly male white supremacy, including, as you mentioned, the persecution of white women throughout Europe under the witch hunts, which lasted over 300 years and affected between 60,000 and 8 million women. One of my Diné Navajo friends really brought it home to me by saying, you know, the Europeans are the descendants of people who watched their mothers and wives and daughters get burned at the stake. What kind of trauma did they carry into this continent and then turn into the oppressors after living through an oppression they've racked upon themselves? But one of the things that comes up for me in thinking about all this is that it seems to me that in some parts of the country, but not all, the belief in white supremacy is not left to rear its ugly head unshakably, but there's a gulf there. Like, there's no new story. Like, what is it that we're holding up as the right way forward? In Michael Moore's new film, Where to Invade Next, he goes to Germany where the children are taught about the Holocaust in a way that helps them commit to making sure it never happens again. But here in America, we don't do that with any of the atrocities that have happened. We're left to try to avoid the truth of history, as you were describing. So my question for you is, what is the alternative? What is the way forward? Or what in your view can be done, should be done, or is being done in very small parts of the American experience? What should be done with this often quite brutal and horrific history that we share on this continent?
Wow. I think that's the ultimate question there. And again, you're right. They don't want to speak to it because it doesn't go with the narrative. And as some scholars have called it, the master narrative. In my first book, Tales from the Whispering Basket, when I wrote the foreword, I was talking about an interview I was once in, and a person asked me, "Where does your pride come from in being Native American?" They were speaking, you know, in an endearing way of like, "What makes you the proudest of being Native American?" I thought about that question and I said, "Well, you know, and actually, I had nothing to do with it being born Native American," and it made me think about all of us as a race or where we come from, our ethnic identities. And I told her, I says, the pride comes from the work that I do in the Native community, the things that I give, not by birth, not by right of birth, just by whatever God or spirituality we believe in, act that happened that made me manifest in this form, as it were. So the pride comes from the work that I give back, whether you're Italian American, Irish. I think the pride needs to come from what you do in that community. And then I went on to talk about how we don't have a choice in the color we're born, but we do have a choice in how we treat each other. I think that's what we need to remember, that we do have a choice, that we don't have to continue to hate. We don't have to contain. These are choices that we're making that are not hurtful and detrimental to our society as a whole. Racism and discrimination, it really, I spend a lot of time thinking about it because it's really a bizarre phenomenon. It's one of those things that it continues not to make sense. We are living in a very modern time of technological breakthroughs, and we have little tiny phones, and we can do all these amazing things. We have the Hubble telescopes, and we can see out, and we can look at tiny things on a subatomic level. But we're still judging people on the basis of what they look like. It's insane, and I see it as a primal leftover of behavior that just continues to linger in our ethos, you know. And it's unfortunate. And, you know, having said that, as I said, the morning road to Thanksgiving, it brings out these vicissitudes, not only with, you know, not white people, but also within Native communities. Because I'll mention Kina, as I mentioned, Nimpa's sister, her husband, his name is George. And George is also a Native American. But by looking at George, you would see a white person. And these are some of the issues that go on within the Native community about identity. And I think Cher was touching on that before about as far as identity. So George is having an identity crisis because he's not necessarily being accepted by other Native people. So here's a man, he looks white for all intents and purposes on the outside, but his grandma, she's a Native person. He grew up, you know, learning about who he was. And so he's going through all these hard times because of what the way the world is set up, you know. And then there's one scene in the book where he's in this place where he's hearing these two white guys, they're making fun of Indians, and George speaks out and says, hey, you know, watch your mouth. I'm a native, I'm Indian too. And one of the guys looks at him and laughs. He says, geez, you're whiter than me, you know? So it's these little humorous parts, but also very revealing parts about how these real life issues come up with people who are indigenous. So the color problem is not just a white person's problem. And that's why I say this is not just a book for non-native people. It's a book for everybody to really learn how we interact. Because like I said, I'm really trying to understand how people or why people are continue on this path of judging by the color of their skin and in these ways that kind of affect our attitude in life. So I find it a very strange thing.
I'm glad that the conversation turned in this direction. This is actually something that I write about in my own book. And I want to get to the issue of racial identity, that Native nations are actually nations that have a political and cultural component. It's not a racial identity. Being part of a Native American nation is a political and cultural identity. And you would never say to somebody that you met from another nation, like say France, that's funny, you don't look French. You know, because there's no preconceived notion of what somebody from France or England might look like. And so when we start thinking about these identities in relation to Native identities, that's just another area where people have a complete lack of knowledge. You know, Native peoples come from all corners of the world and are connected to a number of different environments, which frame and shape our physical appearance, our outward appearance. And so when we start getting into these issues of identity and we start having these stereotypical ideas based on the very limited amount of history that's taught in schools, then, you know, we continue to deny people their authentic identity by projecting our assumed stereotypical identities onto them. So that's something that I think it's really important for people to look at. Another thing that I have come up against oftentimes in the workshops that I teach, public speaking that I do, is people who say, well, you know, we're all one. And so why don't you just drop this Native identity and just consider yourself as the same as everyone else? Why do we refer to people by the color of their skin or their racial group? Why does anybody need, and this is in quotes, special rights in order to protect them, you know, if we're all the same? And I think that one of the things that people don't often think about, don't take it to this deeper level, which is a place where we love to go on the show, is to think about, well, what is the purpose of us all carrying these distinctions? Yes, we know that in a larger spiritual sense, we're all interrelated, we're all interconnected. We know that from a biological scientific perspective as well. So why are there these divisions? You know, certainly some of that can be explained physiologically, but there are also social and psychological divisions that keep people afraid of these others that they see, who they perceive as being different from them. And can we just skip over that and move to this larger sense of oneness? And my response to that is always that this is our learning ground. Yes. You know, we are here to respond to the disparate treatment of those others as part of our process of evolving, that we are being called to address the discrimination of individual groups, whether that be based on the color of their skin or their gender or their sexual orientation, as a means to evolve our own thinking, that this is part of our process of conscious evolution. And so I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are on that, Larry, because I know you and I have had a number of discussions where, you know, we've delved into some of these things pretty deep, and I know you're capable of swimming. So why don't you jump in and let us know what you have to say.
Yeah, I like that. And, you know, when people say that about just being one and so on. So I'll start with, when you think about, you know, I think about my cousin Tallpine, who's our language teacher. And we talk about the language is the ecology of the land. Our words are not only part of our lexicon, but they are literally part of the land, the way we describe the land. The land, the people, the ceremonies all interact with who and what we are.
And we'll be back after a quick break for station ID and some further commentary from Sherry Mitchell.
Each November, educators across the country teach their students about the first Thanksgiving, a quintessentially American holiday. They try to give students an accurate picture of what happened in Plymouth in 1621 and explain how that event fits into American history. Unfortunately, many teaching materials give an incomplete, if not inaccurate, portrayal of the first Thanksgiving, particularly as it relates to the Native American participants. Most school-aged children are taught that Native Americans were invited to the first Thanksgiving feast. Young children's conceptions of Native Americans often develop out of media portrayals and classroom role-playing of the events of the first Thanksgiving. The conception of Native Americans gained from such early exposure is both inaccurate and potentially damaging to others. Therefore, most children do not know the following facts, which explain why many Native Americans today view Thanksgiving as a day of mourning. Before the Pilgrims arrived, Plymouth had been the site of a Pawtuxet village, which was wiped out by a plague introduced by English explorers looking to grab a piece of the New World land. 5 years before the Pilgrims landed, these Native peoples had encountered other Europeans. One European was Captain Thomas Hunt, who started trading with the Native peoples in 1614. He tricked the Native peoples that he was trading with into entering upon his ship and then sold them into slavery in Spain. Many other European expeditions also deceptively lured Native people onto ships and then imprisoned and enslaved them. These expeditions carried smallpox, typhus, measles, and other European diseases to this continent. Native people had no immunity, and some groups, like the Pawtuxet, were totally wiped out, while others were severely decimated. An estimated 72,000 to 90,000 people lived in southern New England before contact with Europeans. 100 years later, their numbers were reduced by close to 80%. This history, this untold history, is one of the many reasons why a number of Native American people view Thanksgiving Day as a day of mourning, because they're remembering all of those who were decimated during the days of first contact. Traditional hospitality and generosity have and continue to be constant tribal virtues practiced at all times. The Wampanoags, the group that first met the Pilgrims, had a number of feast days throughout the year. One of these feast days took place in the late fall. This feast, called Nikomosachmiawin, or Grand Sachem's Council Feast, was the feast where the Wampanoags helped the Pilgrims. During this time, the tribe had amassed food for their traditional feast day and invited the Pilgrims to join them. It was because of this feast in 1621, where the Wampanoags shared their food with the Pilgrims, that the European tradition known as Thanksgiving Day first began. However, as our guest indicated, it was also a day when the Pequot Indians were slaughtered by another group of settlers, and the feast that they held to celebrate the slaughtering of those people was also a Thanksgiving feast. So was the first Thanksgiving in relation to the slaughter of Indians, or was the first Thanksgiving Day a reflection of the generosity of the Indians? We still don't know the exact point in time when this emerged as a national holiday. In 1789, George Washington did proclaim a national day of Thanksgiving that was recognized periodically throughout that period. However, it wasn't until 1863, during the Civil War, that Abe Lincoln proclaimed a national day of Thanksgiving and praise. Of course, this was 1 year after the Dakota 38 were hanged in a mass execution by President Lincoln in December of 1862 in Mankato, Minnesota. So you see, listeners, our history is troubled and wrought with misinformation. So one of the things that we hope that you'll do during this Thanksgiving period is to do a little bit of research. Look at the stories that you have been told. One of the greatest challenges that Native peoples face today is the denial of their authentic identity. This results from these type of generic and inaccurate depictions and the distorted images that arise from mascots. The only way for that to change is for people to begin talking with one another. So go out and connect meaningfully with the Native peoples in your region. Don't make assumptions about who they are. Work to develop a relationship with the people themselves and learn who they are from their own stories in their own words. And now let's go back to our discussion with Larry Spotted Crow Man and see what else we can learn about the first Thanksgiving.
So what we do know, what hopefully everybody's beginning to learn now, as far as indigenous people, we were amazing at studying the stars, the universe. We were scientists, we were doctors, we were healers, and so on. We had an intricate understanding of the universe that goes back thousands and thousands of years. This cultural, intellectual, and spiritual knowledge is what makes us who we are. And, you know, and then as like you read the book by Vine Deloria called God is Red, he talks about how when Christianity was implanted into this hemisphere, which it didn't fit, it was the wrong space, the wrong time, and the wrong story, which leads me to me as a traditional storyteller. I absolutely love telling stories, you know, and the stories are part of the land as well. And I remember I was telling a story, I don't remember which one it was. Somebody asked me, is that true? Did that really happen? You know, when the animals talking and so on. And the most beautiful thing I could have said to him, I said, you know what? It doesn't matter if it happened or not, because you can take the message. And that was the ultimate difference between Christian doctrine and the Native philosophy, is that whether you believe it or not, you can apply it to your life. And having said that, when we speak about creation stories and Native stories, a long time ago, you would have a Nipmuc sachem, or a powwow, as we call them, would come and meet with a Narragansett, a Penobscot powwow, and so on. And these chiefs, these sachems, would gather, and they would each tell their creation story. They would all have different stories, and they would kind of smoke the pipe and share tobacco, and they would like nod and okay, wow, very nice, and here's my story. There was no disagreement about it. And because what they understood was that their story for their place and their time was essential for their existence. That's how they recognize who and what they are. You know, that's how their life is informed, through their story. So when we talk about all of us just becoming one, where we are essentially taking away of the gifts of understanding the cultural, spiritual, and physical environments around us. We're people that survived the Ice Age on this continent here. You know, we lived through that. So all this cultural and intellectual knowledge is part of us. It's ingrained in us. Much of it was stolen and robbed from us, of course. But these are things that are ingrained in us that teach us and inform our life to live. And much like Sherry talked about, is like, we're all given these gifts. We're all given these different things that make sense in our existence. Certain trees grow in certain areas and so on. So we learned and adapted through eons of understanding. And that information is vital to the environment. And that's why we've been called the keepers of the earth, the keepers of the land. That's not just a cliche. It's a truism, because we've understand how to grow it, intensive farming and agriculture, and understanding the seasons to make a life very sustainable for a large population. So if it means getting rid of it and losing all that knowledge, then it would be detrimental to everybody, you know? So it's important that we maintain who we are. And on that note, we know when the first pilgrims came here, we always opened up our arms to outsiders, because it wasn't about you can't come in here, and, you know, any kind of segregation. It was like, okay, we have some new traders and some new people to trade with and conduct business with. And it was fine, you know, because Native people, we would traverse many hundreds of miles and travel. There were trade routes all up and down here, all through the east, all the way to the Missouri. You know, we know that. They found artifacts here that go as far as down as where you are, Revere, in New Mexico. So we know that Native people were traveling. The diffusion of culture was always going on. It was nothing new to have somebody different into your community. But people are learning and trading and understanding from each other. So I think that it's important to hold on to that. And, of course, on a more political level, going back to what I said about the Constitution, well, we can't, if people want to do that, they could say, well, let's just get rid of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. Well, these treaties and claims that were fought and died for by our ancestors are still valid. some of them are still open cases that still haven't been resolved, unfortunately. They're not something that we're going to walk away from because these injustices continue to be go unheard. And we see the evidence in that in the behaviors of our mainstream society, whether it's the Keystone Pipeline, this pipeline now, or the usurpers of tribal lands and so on. So we continue to have to deal with these things as indigenous people.
Larry, one of the things that comes to mind as you're saying that is that people who are of European descent on this continent are also quite ignorant of their own history as well. And they, you know, they frame Europe as France, England, Spain, Germany, these very modern nations compared to the long scope of history, forgetting the Gauls, the Picts, the Saxons, the Norse, the Normans, the Celts, the Romans, the Etruscans, the list goes on. Well over 4,000 years of conquest and colonization that occurred within the framework of Europe. And this was going on all over the world as well, but I'm just going to speak in the European context. But one thing that happens to people of European descent in North America is that when they immigrated to this country, they were expected to and asked to assimilate and adopt the dominant culture that they were entering into, which was basically conquest ideology and domination, period. Yes. Whoever was on top was the dominant culture. And what has ended up historically happening, to my view, in the United States is that that's all we're left with. What shook out of the melting pot was basically bullying.
Right. Well, yeah, well, I was going to say a lot of that was, the English, they literally sent in the Irish and the Scots and Scots-Irish to enslave and clear all these lands, you know, to make way for English settlements. And so these people who were enslaved, the Scots and the Irish, they were essentially used by the English to be the first ones to come in here and do the, quote, dirty work for them. So that was how a lot of them came here.
Right, and we could get into the layers of racism within what we think of as Caucasian or white now, because right. Historically speaking, the Irish were not white, and then they became white by suppressing others. It was a shameful part of American Irish history, that moment. I have a lot of Irish ancestors, so I try to pay attention to these things, because like you said, you know, we have to look starkly at our history and our bloodlines and our cultural bloodline. I don't know if you call them cultural bloodlines, but the cultural evolution of our belief systems that we carry today and that of the places that we come from, not just in terms of our genetics, but in terms of our cultures, the town right. we grew up in, the type of education we got in school, the right. ways of relating to the world.
Right.
Question that's brewing in for me, because this is a big conversation, it's weighty and difficult. I'm wondering what has you mentioned that there's been some pushback in terms of people reading The Morning Road to Thanksgiving, and from unexpected sources, but also from, you know, usual places. I'm wondering if you'd speak a little bit more about what people's reactions are to the book in general, and what kind of conversations it opens with the people you speak with about it. I know you do a lot of public speaking.
Well, for the most part, it's been received quite well. It's won a national award in 2015, and it was the bestseller 2 years in a row at my other publishing house that it was in. And now it's under Crowstorm Publishing, happy to say. It really touched on a lot of sensitivities within the Native community and without. I've had some people say that when they first begin to read the first few chapters, they were very upset with the main character and they wanted to stop reading. But as they went on, they realized, whoa, okay, this is interesting. And I start to understand why this man is so hurt. I understand now why he was so angry. They begin to identify with him. When they hear the suffering that Nipa Stone Turtle endured as a child and the things that he's gone through, and his nightmares begin to reveal themselves, people begin to understand. And that's why I say this book is a book of healing for all of humankind. Just about every contemporary issue that is going on with race relations in a sociological sense, you know, this book deals with it. It touches on it. And you're the observer seeing all this go on, and you'll find yourself in that story. And I have Native people say, well, that I know this person, I know that person, and the non-Native people, you know, and they're just regular people living. And the story takes place all around Thanksgiving, right? So this is a celebratory time, and people are festive and so on. And but you see the other side of the story, and you see the commercialism. You see the sadness that some people experience, and you also see the joy. And so if we're going to have this holiday and hear the story that's been told to us, the wrong story has been told to us as kids, then we need to understand it. And I'll just give a little bit. And this is and I talked to my friend Rhonda about this quite a bit, who's also an indigenous woman from our community. And the story opens up with Nipa reflecting back on his childhood where he was forced, and many of us gone through this, around Thanksgiving, we were to dress up as Indians and pilgrims. And now this little Indian boy is forced to put on this paper feather, and the other kids are putting on pilgrim costumes. And now, mind you, he's grown up in this environment of traditional knowledge. He's understanding who he is, and he knows the value and the sacredness of feathers. And now somebody's making a paper feather and telling him to put it on, and he's literally being humiliated as a child. So this starts young, and this is something that continues to go on in our society. And this little boy suffers that in class, and he doesn't want to put on his paper feather hat. He says, my dad, mom told me we don't do this. We're disrespecting the feathers here by doing this. And this is something that people just passively do in the society without realizing the harm that they're causing or what they're actually engendering in this behavior, that they are disrespecting a culture and a tradition that is very meaningful to a group of people that are indigenous to this land, the first people. So that's something that we see open up in the story, how he's dealing with that.
You know, this conversation is so challenging to so many people. And as a result, people avoid having the conversation. They either go right to get over it or get rid of it. And they can't find the middle ground. They can't find the space where we can sit together and acknowledge that we have this collective wound that we all share. You know, as Rivera was talking about her relatives, and, you were also talking about, Larry, the Irish and Scottish slaves that were charged with pushing the Native people off these lands and settling them, and how there's always been one group pitted against another. Slaves, African slaves, and Black slaves were allowed to become buffalo soldiers to earn their freedom, and their task was to kill Indians. And
exactly,
so
yeah.
When we think about the ways that we have been manipulated, the ways that we have been misled, the distortions and the trauma that we were facing as people, no matter where we came from, being subjected to this onslaught of violence, even those perpetuating the violence, that perpetuating violence leaves a scar on your soul that is greater than any other that you can acquire. And so when we think about the significance of that shared wounding, that shared history. We're actually going to be doing a ceremony next year that's open to people from all over the world, addressing that wound, because we all carry it. Those who were the victims of that violence, those who were the perpetrators of that violence, and even the witness. You know, and yeah. Science has shown that we carry this traumatic memory within our DNA. We have this generational trauma that's passed forward. So people oftentimes react to something in a way that they don't even understand. They're haunted by this memory, this history of trauma that we all carry with us from this horrific past of violence that we all share. And so as we are forging a path forward together, as we're trying to, you know, evolve our consciousness, as we're trying to heal these wounds of our past, do you have any suggestions for our listeners on how to engage the conversation from the very beginning? Because, like I said, so many people want to avoid it altogether and just become polarized in one camp or another. So how would you begin the process of engaging that conversation with people who are maybe afraid to have it?
I think the main thing is that they just want to be acknowledged. They just want to be heard and says, I hear you. I feel what you're saying. I acknowledge what happened. And that has been one of the most difficult things for this country to do in a real, a honest and sincere way, just saying, I hear you and we acknowledge what happened. And unfortunately, that, like I said, it's been very difficult. And these external behaviors and things that we see and show that there's been very little, I don't want to say concern, but you know, the mainstream behavior shows that it's not really paying attention You know, when you hear terms like we're a nation of immigrants, well, not all of us, or hear terms like how great America is. Well, it is great in some sense, but some sense it's not. We quickly want to forget or brush aside, and, you know, with our mascots and all these behaviors. So it's people just, and that's what I really try to do, like I said, with the Morning Road to Thanksgiving. It wasn't a beat up America book. It was really just to get people to look, because there are heroes and people doing things not so good on both sides in the story. And you get to see that we're all just human beings trying to live. So it's about acknowledging and people learn and get educated about who you are, the land that you live on. And my fiance, Samantha, shout out to her. And she tells me that in parts of Canada, they always acknowledge when the speakers, where they're going to do talks, lectures of the indigenous land they're on. And I told her, I said, well, we do that here too. And she said, the non-native people. I says, oh, really? Oh, I says, okay, no. I says, when you go to a lecture of a university or something, and there's just some, whatever topic it could be, you know, far distant from anything cultural, there's no talk of native people. I says, but you're telling me that, like, these people acknowledge the indigenous people? And I'm like, wow, that's pretty amazing. So these are the kind of things that we want to inform this society to really focus on. I mean, what really saddened me, I mean, we watched this election, we watched the debates, and not one word about native people. It's really, it's disheartening. It's like, what about us? You know, and it's hard pressed to find indigenous people on TV, you know, talking and allowed to share, you know. And again, Canada has Aboriginal people's network, and this is something I've been talking about. We need more down here. So I think the key is get educated. And it's not about, like I said, bashing people over the head with history. The Nipmuc people, when we have our ceremonies, our cultural events, everybody is welcome, you know, everybody. And we love to have people of all backgrounds there sharing in that circle, that sacred circle, because we acknowledge the humanity in all people. And people will be surprised that how open we are. And they don't have to be afraid of being judged by their ancestors. It's simply when they can acknowledge and move forward with us, you know, because we all are living on this one planet, right? And we all have to work out the solution together. And kind of going back, what we talked about before is about everybody just being one and forget about what we are. But, well, we can't do that because our ancestors left us with these teachings that are beneficial to this land that we're from. We haven't gone anywhere. We're still right here on this land that we were, been here for thousands of years. And that traditional knowledge is a healing, not just for us, but for everybody. These teachings are for everybody. You know, they're not just for us. They belong to this land, you know? So I think that's the way it's acknowledge, educate, and heal together.
I think one of the things about oneness that always comes up for me, because it irks me as well, is that, you know, from an interconnection standpoint, we can say that we are all interconnected and the interconnected web makes us all one. That doesn't make us all the same. It makes us a vibrant diversity of a lot of different parts of a great big ecosystem of life. And that's what's yes. The beautiful thing. And the oneness that is sameness is really quite boring when you think about it. It's really quite tragic as a concept. But the oneness that is our connection to one another within our diversity is the beauty, is the kind of the long promise and the long arc of humanity, that if we can do the healing, if we can speak truth, if we can meet each other eye to eye and heart to heart, as Sherry right. has said on the show before, then we have a chance to enter a phase of human history that many of us cannot even conceive of and might be quite remarkable. I want to let the listeners know, because we're getting down towards the end of the show, that this is Larry Spotted Crow Man who we're speaking with, and he's the author of The Morning Road to Thanksgiving. He also is a cultural educator and a really remarkable human being whom I'm honored to have this conversation with this week. Larry, we have a few more minutes left, and I know there's probably a lot in your heart and a lot on Sherry's heart, too, to have in this conversation, which we should have again and in more and more depth. But what are some thoughts to share with our listeners, just as closing remarks to have them ponder as we go off? Some of them will be going off to Thanksgiving. Some of them will be going off to conversations with family members that may bring up some of the topics we've talked about today. Some of them won't be celebrating Thanksgiving, possibly. But what are some ideas for them to ponder?
Okay, well, I certainly want to thank you guys for having me. It's been a real pleasure and a treat to share about this book and my life and kind of the story of my ancestors here in Turtle Island. But just to back up real quick about the term, like we said, melting pot, and I would always ask the question, what are we melting into? And I think that's the troubling term, the melting pot, where and the oneness does come from when we do one thing, we are affecting the vibrations of all of our humanity, all of our creation. And that's part of why the No Dakota Access Pipeline people are out there, our relatives are out there fighting for that, because that clean water, water is life. That's for everybody. And they're not just doing that for Standing Rock. They're doing it for all of humanity, to protect that water, protect the soil by keeping that stuff in the ground. And so I would say to people, as they're going away to this Thanksgiving holiday, whether you celebrate it or not, to be thankful, be grateful for your family, the love that you have. And as I said earlier, when I first opened up that harvest, which you're harvesting, that love and that friendship and that kindness, and just to give. This is a time of year, and it should be every day, but this is especially the time of year to give and to share and to love and be grateful for those people who are in your lives, and you know, look them in the eyes and give them a hug and a kiss and say, thank you for being in my life. And I think that's important, and acknowledge the first people of this land, you know, and try to remember us for our sacrifices in every aspect you can. You know, Native people are the highest rate of the enlisted military per ethnic group. So we've served this country in every way possible. And it's not about remembering us in the way of sorrow, but remember us in the way of thanks, that we are not only still here, but we're gonna continue to thrive and bring back what was lost, and that they can be a part of that. We're not in this alone. We want people to be a part of this with us. We have many friends, as I said, from all over. And I was fortunate enough to travel around the world with my book to Sweden and Iceland and Greenland and different parts. And I've met so many wonderful people of all different backgrounds, people from Australia when I was in Montreal. And I realize people are the same everywhere. People want love. People want kindness and generosity. And that giving spirit is within all of us. So I would say to honor that and kind of use that against anything that would bring harmful to our people, our humanity. That's what I would say.
Larry, thank you so much for joining us on the show today and sharing your story and pretty good glimpse of the story of your book, The Morning Road to Thanksgiving. Where can folks buy the book if they're interested in getting a copy?
Great question. They can go to whisperingbasket.com to get the book. That's my website. And I'm also elated to mention my new book I'm working on is entitled Drumming and Dreaming. It's going to be a book of tribal legends. It's in the works, coming out soon. But for right now, hope you come and check out The Morning Road to Thanksgiving. And I really appreciate everybody who listened.
Thanks this week to our guest, Larry Spotted Crow Man, and to my remarkable co-host, Rivera Sun. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is also performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thanks to my co-host, Sherry Mitchell, for bringing magic to these conversations week after week. I always feel that together we are doing the healing work we so often talk about. You can find more of her wisdom on her Sacred Instructions Facebook page. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. This week we heard from Larry Spotted Crow Man about his book, The Morning Road to Thanksgiving. This opened up a great deal of discussion about our assumptions and how we identify ourselves and others. We all make assumptions about people, and many of those assumptions are fed by the perpetuation of misinformation. The burden, therefore, rests on us. We are responsible for our own learning. We are the ones that must go out there and engage all those others and take the time to learn who they are from them. So, listeners, maybe you could take a bit of time and go out and meet someone that is different than you and learn their stories in their own words by the time we talk to you next week.
Turn back.